Okay, is everybody back?
Yes. Yep,
Good.
yep.
Okay, so we'll start with announcements. Does anybody have announcements?
Nothing.
I have one. This is Minda over at National Center for Science Education. I know that Kate sort of introduced herself earlier, but Kate Heffernan is our new summer intern. She's going to be launching our teacher network. NCSC has never actually had a defined teacher network before, so we're launching that this summer to have a sort of roll up to the fall. So I'll be emailing folks probably in a month or two, just to like where our Facebook page is, where our Twitter account is, how to get teachers signed up, and if folks could share that would be super with all your different networks, because we'd love to really tie in more teachers to what we're doing.
Right. So what are you intending to have the people do on the as part of the network?
Yeah, so our first step is to just make sure teachers know about it. Like pretty basic first step. But then also we're going to be providing different things. We're going to be working with Climate Voices to try to get more scientists to be working with teachers in the classroom, as well as a newsletter I've started on our blog with Stephanie Keep, a series of sort of educator-specific materials that are available to them. So all kinds of things, just trying to build out that whole arm of what NCSC can do with educators. So I'll make that a little bit more concrete when I send around my email, just in terms of like what, so you know which teachers might be interested and so on.
Any other announcements?
Minda, this is Frank Nichols. Did I see that South Dakota adopted the NGSS?
Can you say that again, Frank? I'm having trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry. This is Frank Niebold. Minda, did I see correctly that South Dakota adopted the NGSS, or is there an update there?
Minda, you still on?
Sorry, I was muted. I apologize. Yeah, it looks like they did. And I'm trying to figure out if they actually called it NGSS, because a couple states adopt and then don't call it that. But yeah, it looks like they've taken it on. And my colleague Josh reviewed the climate change piece, and it didn't look like there was any bad manipulation of it. Has anyone else heard anything else about that?
I mean, I haven't heard anything. I mean, I saw something come across. I think, from your when you post something new, it shows up as a news article, and it'd be interesting to see. That's a new state.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising, actually.
Is this
But,
a state that people were had doubts about? I mean, I don't really know the individual states all that well.
yeah, that's a good question. I guess I was personally a little bit surprised, just because I feel like some of the easier states, like it just kind of went a little bit easier than I thought it would. So I just checked with my colleague Glenn, and they adopted their own sort of brew of standards. And they just so happened to be very similar to NGSS. Sort of like how Oklahoma did something similar. So yeah, that's what I thought, is that it just, oh, what a coincidence. It's incredibly similar to NGSS. So a couple states have taken that route, but due to sort of internal politics, wouldn't necessarily say that that's what they did.
Because, I mean, the blog post that you have here is that they are not significantly different. But
Yeah.
for West Virginia, when they changed one word from rise to change, that made them not an NGSS state officially,
Yeah.
but they're an NGSS
fairly close state.
Yeah.
Which is the NDSS adapted states, like Massachusetts and Oklahoma and West Virginia.
Yeah. So I think what you're picking up on is like a little bit of internal politics within the states as to whether or not they can admit to whether they've adopted it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They don't want to show up on the map that says NGSS adopted states.
Yeah. Because certain states have certain perspectives on states' rights, and they don't want to be affiliated with anything that could potentially be perceived as federal control of their educational system. And so a couple states have sort of used NGSS as their model, but then not called it NGSS or sort of portrayed it as, oh no, this is not NGSS at all. whereas it very clearly is.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I've kind of struggled with a bit as I try to think through developing teacher professional development programs is that in a state that's not adopting, but basically, you know, there's a lot of pieces of it they are adapting, or the teachers really buy into things like the science and engineering practices. How do you approach groups in which you want to partner with if it's not politic to say, you know, you're bringing a component of the next generation science standards, or you're bringing professional development will help them address the next generation science standards? What is it that what is the kind of language to get it being able to attract those teachers without making them feel like, well, my state's not doing that, so it's not relevant to me?
Hi, Tamara, it's Jason in Ohio. I know what we do here because we've gone through a transition, and I think this is true of most states. You just need to cite the name of the standards within the state. So most people in those professional organizations will know the linkage anyways. But what you just say is that whatever you're coming in with, your PD, is directly applicable to whatever standards the state is using. So in ours, it's the new learning standards.
Yeah,
and
that's
their de facto thing they're looking to, just like those other states would look at NGSS.
So, Jason, organizations like EdGate and other organizations that do cross-alignment work for, this NGSS standard, I mean, this is back when before NGSS, right, where you would have, like, here's the Sunshine State standards, here's the Virginia standards, are we going back into that space where we have to, because of the politics, use the services like that to be able to say this curricular work that or professional development is related to your standard? See, it's right here, but for organizations that serve all educators, to be able to come in, because, you know, at NSTA you have people from lots of different states in the room. And so, or they come to your website, you have to serve multiple audiences. You can't just serve just the ones that are in one state. You know, do you think we have to go back to those tools that we used to use with, you know, pull it down, here's your state kind of thing?
I think at the good thing is, at least at the content level, they're much, much more closely aligned than they ever were in those states. And actually, Minda's document's really helpful because it helps us know, okay, this band of states, even if they don't have the exact same language everywhere in the document, are so similar, we can know as we target them that the standards are similar. There are places you're going to have to use semantic arguments and say, and that's much easier if you're within the state or at a PD session you're marketing to an audience within the state to say, these directly apply to these state standards. So at the content level, there's going to be overlap. The people that in the big organizations at the state level, even in the state offices, will know what the linkages are. You're going to have to play some semantic games here and there, but at least it's not a shotgun approach where every state's doing its own thing, and there really was not, in the past, there was not any linkage between states necessarily. But, I mean, that's the game we play here. We don't have NGSS. many of the people that do PD across the state would love to have it. Just always have to say our stuff lines to Ohio standards.
Would it be useful to have a singular document possibly posted online that that points to all the climate change standards within different states so that, you know, if it's not an NGSS state, then at least point to where it was so that it'd be easier for folks to align with that?
Well, Minda, I think probably what you need is not a document, but more like an API, so that you can pull in the data from once you've done the analysis. You really need to pull in the data to your digital resources so that you can say, you know, this analysis for this state shows it here, and this analysis for this state shows it here. But when I'm generating a result on a page and you're looking at the standards, all that work shows up on that page without me having to go into hand code at all.
Okay.
It's the kind of stuff Ted Willard does at MSDA.
Sorry, I missed what you said. Apologize.
Ted Willard over at MSDA.
Uh-huh.
And we've worked, and then there's services like EdGate who do,
uh-huh,
you know, these services out for fees for business. But,
yeah,
you know, they give you data that is usable for, you know, other purposes.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
I just heard that we need to go back to those services that we hoped we could walk away with NGSS, but that doesn't look like it's going to be possible.
Yeah, but I think things are probably a little bit more easier. It's probably easier to point to the connections now than it was ever before.
Or the same project, you know, here is the organic carbon cycle, you know, it's the reality is the curricular work or the professional development is going to be much closer to the standards because they're much more like each other than in the past where it's, or some of these things are real stretches.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what I heard Jason say.
Yes. Sorry, if anybody asked a question, I ended up hitting disconnect as opposed to mute on my phone, and I...
We were wondering why you didn't answer those questions.
Yeah, I volunteered for a committee to run something, or...
It's just joking.
Probably. yeah, I guess my question is, given our... the situation that we're in now with many states, you know, not all of them, but several taking on NGSS and many others using NGSS as a basis so that at least, at the very least, climate change typically is addressed in some fashion. Would those who develop curricular materials, to what extent do you feel like you need to have a state-by-state sort of like analysis of where climate change fits in? How useful is that to you?
I don't know whether you want an analysis of where climate change fits in to any particular standards, because it can vary by school district to school district.
Mm.
You know, even though they have the same, a state will have the same standards, the way teachers teach it can vary from school district to school district. So, which is another point that I wanted to sort of get at, is that we learned a few weeks ago that, I think some of us knew, but that individual teachers and individual school districts, even in states that are not adopting, are in fact adopting. And so we need to be able to support those kinds of groups in addition to just at the state level. So...
Well, it relates to a conversation I recently had with Ted Willard about the district adoption ahead of state adoption, where you have, like, say, Denver is moving ahead of Colorado, or Austin is moving ahead of Texas. And while there are some state local control issues, which is interesting, it's going the opposite way sometimes as arguments go. But how to connect resources to practice is, I think, you know, Minda, what you're getting at is going to be really interesting and rich. But you know, how to do that we got to get some efficiency here. And I think, you know, having some people who are kind of sharing the same problem it would be a good idea. Between and the other thing to remember is when Scott and I, you know, we did that NGSS alignment exercise back oh so long ago, Scott. You know, the range of where climate and energy literacy show up in the NGSS is huge. We've never finished it all the way out, but we know it's excessive of 30%. I think it's a fair estimate.
Yep.
And, you know, that's from kindergarten all the way up to 12th grade. And so I think that the, you know, it because the engineering design stuff is really rich. It shows up in the biology and the biological systems in a really rich way. So I think it's bigger than climate change. But I think, you know, that's the impulse that gets us why we care about it.
If I can say something, one of the things I think you should be aware of is that there are, Minda and a bunch of you are already aware of it, I don't know if all of you are, that individual teachers in various states often get a misconception about how things are listed in the standards, and a lot of people mistakenly think that because a lot of not just climate change, but a lot of the physical aspects of ecology are listed under earth science, that they belong in an earth science class rather than a biology class. And nationwide, well, first of all, that's incorrect, because I've spoken with several people who in fact worked on the NGSS together, and they said, no, those are just disciplinary labels, and that obviously if you're going to talk about biology and about ecology, you have to talk about the physical aspects of the niche incorporated with the biological aspects of the niche. And the word of choice is bundling, that you bundle together various different standards, some from earth science, some from biology, et cetera, in the NGSS to create a coherent course. And I think that's something you might want to point out in your materials, because otherwise teachers might think, well, I teach a life science course, and you've got all this climate change stuff in here that's under earth science, so I don't need to do that.
Yeah, I think the concept of bundling is really good. And the other reason that I think that that really helps, if you bundle the performance expectations, then as you work through a group of you know, an area which has this bundle of performance expectations, you don't necessarily need to have your activities incorporate into one piece of that the connected performance expectation, the connected disciplinary core ideas, science and engineering practice, and cross-cutting concepts in any one piece of it, but that you need to integrate it through the entire thing. And I think that that helps in terms of thinking through how to teach a particular part of the content for a bundle of performance expectations.
But I think, you know, these standards are very different than any standard we've ever seen before, and especially the three-dimensional learning aspect and learning progressions. To then layer on bundling, which is a very creative process, puts a lot of load on teachers to create a course that is bundled, and then somebody else is creating a different course that is bundled, and that's a lot of work.
Right.
Just an amazing amount of work.
Well, I'm anticipating that it would be on us, those of us who are involved in curriculum development work and professional development work, to provide that framework for teachers.
Absolutely.
So that they don't have to put that together themselves. Because I agree, it's not easy. It's not at all easy.
Yeah, and we're in the middle of that right now. In fact, I agree with you completely. It's up to curriculum material developers and people who do PD to do the bundling for them. And if they have a couple of different bundles to choose from, that's just like choosing from different instructional material.
But one of the challenges that comes with NGSS is the all students, all standards aspect, right? So how to, you know, it's almost like you have to bundle the whole thing together in order for you to have justice to that principle of all students, all standards. Because if we're all bundling pieces, then it's very easy for us to see a gap show up where somebody never paid attention to that part to bundle it in somewhere, or the students never got access because it you know kind of sits between the bundles, and it's very easy to envision a climate is left out of the bundling that somebody else's bundling problem.
I think, though, in the PD, if you give a really good storyline that's robust and you can show people examples of things and have other resources they can turn to following the PD, you've given them a good model to emulate. You have to trust that they're going to have to do some stitching together of pieces based on their circumstances.
Yeah.
Every situation is so unique. So if you give them two or three really robust examples of what it looks like with the content done well, the three-dimensionality, kind of learning progressions, appreciating where the students are coming from, I think then you turn to the clean collection and say, but here's a vast repository of stuff that you can use to put together other pieces in your curriculum we didn't have time for in this PD.
I think that the PD is really crucial, and it's going to take time, but that doesn't mean that... So I think it's going to be a combination of building the teacher's skills to be able to really think in this really new way of teaching.
But, I mean, there's another thread of this discussion, which is you have states like West Virginia, which are NDSS adapting states, one word, but still adapting, that are going to be teaching ninth graders, you know, earth science across the entire state in a year and a couple months. So they're gonna, the implementation phase where they actually are requiring the new structures is going to be, you know, we're looking at a little bit over a year. So what are we going to do to help them in a little over a year? That's an open question. I don't have the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't
know that anyone has the answer.
That's a challenge.
It is a huge challenge. I think people that have ongoing activities are going to have to wrestle with this as they move forward. And I think that there's also this issue of, I think we can all probably think of ways that we might address this, but we also need to have the funding to make it happen, and that's a real problem right now.
It's a huge problem.
What?
It's a huge problem, Tamara.
Yes, yep, it is.
So I'm not trying to change the subject, but since it came up, I'm sort of curious what people sense is regarding the funding issue that I saw in the news for NOAA and for NASA and how that's going to trickle down to education and development of materials for the next year or so.
Amanda, I can speak to some of that. I mean, the public documents that are out there right now, so I'm not giving you anything inside. I am a civil servant, so I'm not saying anything that I know without public knowledge. It's unclear as to how the funding is going to work on the new starts that are being requested for FY15 or are looking to start in FY16.
Okay.
It's very unclear what the funding is going to come from. And, you know, between, you know, the FY16 money that the budget is now talking about, I think that it's fair to say the discretionary dollars are going to be less in NASA and NOAA and NSF for these kinds of things, and the targeted money is going to be less. How much less is unclear. But, I mean, federal money has been dwindling since 2010 in this space, and, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to be showing back up anytime soon.
That's a shame.
And just to add one more piece, is the philanthropic has not come in.
They're funding energy and climate, and they're funding education, but they're not funding the intersection. There's no major funder in the philanthropic space who's looking at this as a priority area, which is, so we're losing, ground on all fronts.
Do other people agree with that? Because that is my observation, too, that there is no major funder stepping into this space. And it's a problem at every level. There are, not only are there schools that are having to go without PD, but there are organizations that provide PD that are just closing up shop left and right because there's no funds for them to operate.
It's troubling.
That's why your stuff is so important, Minda.
Oh, thanks. Like everyone's stuff is so important.
So nobody knows of any other sources of funds on the horizon?
Shucks.
I can.
That's what we've all been struggling with.
Yeah, I mean, I can speak from our experience over at NCSC, is that, and I think Mark had got the brunt of this experience because he was here even before I was, is that people are really excited about climate change communication, and there are certainly some major funders in that avenue, and people are excited about environmental education to a certain extent, but then, when we would talk to these same kinds of funders about climate change education, there was this very blasé attitude about it. I don't know to what extent that still is the case, but that definitely was very surprising to me, that there was this sort of very, education doesn't matter piece. I'm hoping that we're working on turning the tide on that a little bit, and maybe some people have some positive stories to share on that, but I did. That was definitely at least my initial experience coming to NCSC, and it was quite surprising.
But it is surprising that they're interested in environmental education, but not climate change education. It seems to me that those are very so much linked.
Yeah.
But the practitioners and the funders don't see it. When we talk to the Blue Sky Funders Forum, which is about growing the philanthropic commitment to environmental education, it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
We've been part of that since its inception. And other funding organizations, and, it's just there seems to be a conceptual gap when you talk about education and almost anything but climate or energy, and they see the connection. But when it comes to this, there seems to be some barrier to why education is important to this. And we've made written documents about this. I mean, that's what the Climate Literacy Guide and the Energy Literacy Guide were. But
yeah,
it just hasn't made the case that investments in this space are critical to solving these climate and energy challenges that we face. And I don't know how we can do it better than we've already done it, but clearly we still have work before us.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, I may be able to report back in another 6 or 8 months or so, because I'm applying to join an advisory council for the Stellwagen Bank National Sanctuary Committee, and they are specifically going after now, although they hadn't so much before, they're specifically interested now in pursuing middle and high school level education because their explicit goal is to create environmentally informed voters for the future. And I wonder if, in the abstract, that might be some way to go back to funders. Have you already tried that, or do you think it's implicit in what you say?
Mm. Well, I mean, the only thing as a NOAA person, when the sanctuaries talk about what you just described, they really focus on climate and ocean literacy,
mm-hmm.
More than environmental. And so, I mean, it's very connected to what we're talking about. I would think it's wider than just the civic part of voting. I think it's all forms of civic life. That includes voting, but it's beyond that as well. So anyway, I mean, it's very connected. But I think, you know, getting a science mission connected to an education initiative is a critically, you know, if we make success somewhere, we got to make success where we can make it.
I'm wondering if it's maybe because some of the connections, thinking of Ohio, we can point to the algal situation in Lake Erie, and you can look at nutrients and fertilizer, and it's maybe easier to make the connection between other environmental threats. As we talk about climate change here, we're trying to talk in terms of that, like, threat multiplier and the idea this is connected to other issues that maybe are more tangible to folks, have been around for longer, that they see X leads to Y, and make the connection there, that for some folks, they still think this is far off in the future. It's a little less tangible because we've been trying to connect folks where they already are, where other existing threats are. Because I would agree that people are willing to fund other stuff more that seems to lead to certain tangible, deliverable products, like to create a center for education, to create a workshop on some topic, to preserve a forest. But the climate stuff maybe is around the periphery, if there at all. I think we're making an inroads with making it higher up on the radars of people that are in positions where they're well-connected and they're able to bring us into other constituencies because it's a high priority for them, and then maybe that other organization makes it a higher priority for themselves. But it doesn't show up high in people's radar.
Jason, is that there are two audiences I'm maybe crossing the wires on. The funder, who doesn't see the connection, and the audience, who doesn't see the connection. Starting where they are is kind of more an audience approach as opposed to a funder approach, because you figure the funder is more sophisticated in their understanding, has deeper appreciation and understanding of the significance of the issue and all that kind of stuff. Or are they pretty really similar?
I guess for some of the ones I'm thinking of in Ohio, you know, it's your park system where you have, you can come to donors, you can come to your agency with ideas for programs, and in some cases, there might be money to do those, but the agency doesn't really see it meeting an audience need or even showing up on their radar as a real threat, so they're not doing any programs. So even agencies that have the resources internally here to do stuff, it doesn't show up as a high needs area. You know, you're worried about, we need to reduce fertilizer loading into the lake and runoff, high priority. As far as that being exacerbated by warmer temperatures and lake water, that isn't showing up as a big thing to worry about. And so they'll invest a lot to do training in other areas. And now, philanthropists would maybe a different thing, but a lot of the agencies here would have built-in funds to do PD for educators and for their own staff. And those staffs in informal ed will reach a few thousand people a year in each of those agencies. So we did Metro Parks training this year, and it was really because one naturalist who worked with us on the programs, they have a budget, but she was the one to spearhead the effort to get it there, and then her goal is to get some of those naturalists at the other parks to have PD sessions for educators, and she's doing one this summer. And they had money to bring to the table to do their PD, but this, it wasn't showing up as a high-need area.
One of the things that NCSC did as they were getting off the ground on this, and Minda, you can give any details you feel are necessary,
sure,
is doing a readjustment from saying, quote unquote, just climate change to global change at a broader level. And I found in lecturing to audiences around the country that if I talk about global change and include climate, it seems to take the political edge off of climate change, whereas if I just talk about climate change, people say, oh, you've got to be a friend of Al Gore, right? Whereas global change, including nitrogen, including land use change, including introduced species, you know, all that kind of stuff, could that be a mechanism to sort of bundle, for want of a better term, climate change with some of the things like eutrophication that people are more tangibly aware of?
I mean, I can always add to the conversation on this. You know, when we were working with the museum, a anthology over at UC Berkeley on our Understanding Global Change site. Part of the reasoning was that, you know, let's be expansive and not just have this be about climate change and address multiple issues. But I think that, you know, in terms of what NCSC focuses on, there really isn't sort of global change denial in the same way that there's sort of climate change denial. People, and maybe because it's like people can see eutrophication, people can physically see urbanization, those kinds of things. And so it's really a lot easier to sort of talk about those things. And so in some cases, bundling it helps a lot from an educational perspective. But also, I want to resist the urge to sort of shy away from using scientific terms that are publicly unpopular. Because, you know, on the one hand, you want to be able to communicate effectively, but on the other hand, I feel like we'd be chasing our tails a lot if we're always trying to sort of hide from anti-science folks, you know.
You know, it occurs to me, there was an interesting article I read in Grist over the weekend that talked about why the reframing strategy away from talking about climate change and talking about these other things about innovation, energy security, and economic competitiveness as proxies for softening the front load of talking about climate change. And they make a compelling argument. This is quite some time ago, actually. It occurs to me now, I'm looking at the data on this, and this was from 2011, was that, you know, if you're going to focus on this issue, the speed and severity, and you have to stay focused on the root problem. And it just requires too much focus in order for us to make progress. And if we move around and kind of reframe it, we're never going to get the speed which society needs to be taking this seriously. And that was their analysis back in 2011, and I very much resonate with that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Which way to do this?
No.
I mean, does that make sense to you guys?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. Yeah, it does. You know, I think I guess I struggle a little bit just on multiple levels because you know, my own sort of stubbornness. I don't want to keep that in the way of, you know, being effectively an effective communicator or educator. But I am also like, if this is what the term is, you know, this is what it is, and, you know, this is the reality of it. And in some ways, I feel like we just have to be kind of like, I'm really sorry that this makes you uncomfortable. Because, you know, we change the term climate change to global change, and then, you know, we'll have people following that and being like, well, global change doesn't exist.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I think that even within the scientific community, people are realizing that, you know, as Camille Parmesan said a long time ago in her science article about, you know, the dangers of over-attribution, what are often described as effects of climate change are often actually, in terms of ecological effects, the result of climate change plus nitrogen, plus introduced species, plus, land use change. And so, and what was interesting was over the weekend, I met a friend of a nephew who happens to be a postdoc at the Yale School of Forestry. And so naturally I mentioned to him that op-ed piece several weeks ago by Nadine, I'm trying to remember her last name, basically saying don't plant trees to do something about climate, that set off quite a firestorm. And although it turns out there's complicated science within that itself, because this fellow I met is doing a postdoc on methane release by trees. And it turns out that, you know, trees release methane fairly significantly. And so their effect on climate isn't just the thing. But what he said her point was meant to be was not don't plant trees, but don't predicate the need to replant deforested areas exclusively on climate, because that may not be your best bet. You know, there are other reasons to do that that have to do with other kinds of anthropogenic change.
Yeah, I think that's that's a good point. That is a really good point.
You know, there was a project that NOAA funded, the Office of Education, called the World Views Network, and they used the planetary boundaries framework as the organizing structure for their engagements. And climate change is just one of those planetary boundaries that need to be looked at. And the nitrogen is another one. Biodiversity loss is another one. There are, you know, you can find it very easily. But that's a good scientific-based framework for looking at
resilience. Sir, to put that out.
What's that?
I just said it was the Stockholm Resilience Center that put that, the planetary boundaries work out. There's about 7 boundary areas.
Right.
And then and some of their work, I'm trying to remember, it might have been Steve Carpenter, but there's several folks who also indicate where we are with respect to those boundaries, too. So it's kind of a snapshot and, give us an idea of where we are in terms of going across those boundaries. So important work, and I guess the take-home message is that these things are all interrelated. It's good to be ecologists, we'll say. Yeah, this is it's an interesting thing. As I've been listening to the conversation, I've kind of in the back of my mind have been wondering, well, did we make a strategic error when we pulled out climate as something to focus on and focus on climate literacy, and in separating that away from all these other issues, we've planted a good target on our backs, and maybe in fact we would have done better if we just simply talked about doing great science, and that would have been our focus. And in the process of doing great science, we also would have needed to deal with climate issues then too. I don't know.
Well, in hindsight, it's easy to say that, but I don't think anybody really imagined that climate denialism would grow to the extent that it has. So I don't think there was any way for us to know back then that we were going to find ourselves in this situation.
Yeah, and there's no going back.
I would expect to say science denialism, not just climate denialism.
That's true.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, yeah,
sure.
I mean, that's why NCSE exists.
Yeah. Deal with that a lot.
But, you know, there's another piece to this, which is that the, back in 2005, 2006, 7, 8, we were focused on, global warming and climate change. And we understood why we needed to focus on that, and time was important. And then, things got harder, and lots of other things went into that mix. But the shift to focus on other topics that are, you can kind of backload climate change. You know, the carbon emissions reductions and all that kind of stuff. There are even people that focus on adaptation only because of that exact issue. I think ultimately are doing us a grave disservice. And the other thing is that it kind of puts the scientific community in a weird place where we have to not talk about the seriousness of which the science is saying, and we kind of we're I don't know what the right way of saying it is, but we're not. I think we're doing a disservice to the science. A lot of times, scientific communications will trim the tails, the probability distributions, and only talk about. They won't talk about the standard deviations couple out, and they'll leave off the very, very low likelihood, high impact stuff that is in the science. But is that a denial of its own form that's coming from the scientific community because they want to soften and not look like radicals when you're actually doing something very disingenuous to your position?
Yeah, my sense, having looked at this, is that it's a combination of scientists' appropriate determination not to overstate their findings. I mean, we're all brought up to think in terms of confidence limits. And the public simply does not understand that. And politicians who have an axe to grind grab on that lack of understanding and say, well, they can't say 100% for sure that this is going to happen. By, you know, so many degrees of warming by such and such a time, so many millimeters of sea level rise, you know, it's about a mismatch between what science has traditionally done and what scientists have done in talking to each other, and exactly what you said, that the predictions include a curve with very serious extremes.
Yes.
And in my talk, I use an animation of a bell curve shifting up that I came across. And if people want, I can send a link to, I forget where the original one came from, but I can send you a link to my Dropbox folder where I have that. And that's a very dramatic demonstration of the mean shifting doesn't mean much in the middle of the curve, but it dramatically increases the high-end extreme events in terms of probability.
Hmm.
And, you know, some of those, when you look at the really, really high-end extreme stuff that's in the science, it's jaw-dropping.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if somebody sits in the climate office at NOAA, we get this often. And it's I think if we go back to the NGSS conversation, really, one of the things to remember is that we tend to focus on the DCI stuff, but the cross-cutting concepts and the science and engineering practices actually have richer information or approaches than what we had in the climate and energy and ocean and literacy principles in regard to being able to skillfully use, understand, interpret, and communicate science for a purpose that is societally relevant.
I
really agree with that. I think that's why I really think that focusing professional development around the science and engineering practices is a way to help teachers really, in a concrete way, address the next generation science standards, because they themselves need to develop those skills.
Exactly.
I mean, as far as resources, I don't think I think that this, in some ways, the next wave of curricular development that is going to pull from the great content-related educational products that we've had over the years and really weave them in and augment and strengthen them with related to the cross-cutting concepts and science engineering practices in a real way to get at the probability distribution curve analysis. I mean, that's... Rarely do we do anything like that I've seen. I mean, maybe there's some hidden ones out there, but you know, drawing them out and improving them is going to be hugely important for dealing with this.
Yeah, I can say that in virtually no place in ordinary high school curricula is there anything like looking at probability curves. I mean, we get pushback when we try and give them something as simple as the Hardy-Weinberg equation. That's too much math. That's heavy duty.
Yeah.
Our kids can't handle that. Never mind probability. So maybe do you at NOAA have any resources that do what you just talked about, which is emphasizing the cross-cutting concepts in science and engineering practices to develop more scientific thinking around the content?
Well, so one of the things that a group of us are working on is kind of restructuring in essence, creating a guide to teaching the NRC framework as it relates to climate, and weaving together these points in a more overview way, as not a curricular way, but in a how would a curriculum resource developer or a teacher bundle these things, if you take the NGSS language, that take the existing materials and then weave them together in a meaningful way to bundle them, right? We're just getting there now. And I think, Tamara, that you know, we're working on a piece of this and some other people are working on a piece of this. But at the bottom line, we have to figure out how to help kind of call out what the science skills are as they relate to climate and energy, that in much more effective ways than we've done to date. And the raw materials are out there, but we haven't made the the great meal. We just got a bunch of raw materials sitting around in the kitchen. Some of us are looking at it and going, maybe we should make a meal here. Let's see if we can do a good one.
As we get hungry. Hungrier. Yeah.
It's a community need. I mean, this is a huge community need. I mean, that's something that I, as a program manager at NOAA, see. And I hope that we as a community can help generate something quickly to help people as they figure out how to do this. But, I mean, just I love that probability distribution problem because it's a real big one.
Well, it's, you know, I actually did some work on this, you know, actually when I was a postdoc, and ended up writing a paper called The Role of Rebels, which was basically making the claim that it is exactly those extremes on the probability distribution curves that drive any kind of nonlinear behavior. Now, I came at that as a chemist, and there's a whole slew of notions of something called dissipative structures. And you find that the behavior of those systems is really driven by those extreme ends, the so-called non-Poisson character. There's a phrase for you. And when you recognize that many of the systems that we deal with are nonlinear in exactly this way, you start to realize that this is where the action is, which is, of course, why I called the paper The Role of Rebels. It's the things on the extremes that really drive the average behavior of systems. So I totally agree with this. Normal distributions ain't going to get you there. You're going to have something a little different than that. And these are extremely important ideas. And, you know, I think as Joe said, it's like you don't see this in the high school curriculum. But I think it's really important. It's not that hard to show. the algebra is relatively simple to show that it is those things that are different than a standard deviation that actually will drive the average behavior of a system. So I really should publish that paper more broadly than I did back then. So.
Okay. Anyway. Can you share it again?
Hmm?
Can you share it with the network?
You know, it's actually ended up in multiple forms, and none of which were actually complete. But, I think that's something that I need to set on my table for the next couple of months is to put that into a form that, is more of a two- or three-page paper rather than, you know, something that's 20 or 30 pages long. So, yeah. It's even just doing the simple example for the chemical system, and it also works in ecology too. It's really powerful to see how that just falls out fairly quickly. Important
stuff. Scott, do you see the connection to the precautionary principle as far as how to use information to make decisions? Another extension piece of that?
Yeah, it is also related to that because. Because that's what rebels do. That's how change happens, in whether it's a social system or an ecological or a chemical system. It is the outliers that really have an enormous impact on the on what happens in a system. So precaution tells you, make sure that you are able to respond to those kinds of changes. Yeah. It's all interesting relationships between these things.
Just wish we had the money to fund all this to accelerate it quickly.
I know.
Yes.
Yeah, and actually, were the media reports of the cuts specifically directed at NOAA accurate? I hope not, but were they?
Well, I mean, it's all public record, guys. So the cuts, as I understand them, just be clear, this is the House that we're talking about, and the Senate has to come in, and then the President has to decide what he's going to do relative to that budget.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the cuts to NASA's Earth Sciences were very significant, and the question is whether or not that budget will be voted on and passed into law, or will it be vetoed? And this is civics at its best, right? We'll find out what the end of all of this is. Will we get a continuing resolution that doesn't make those happen? We get the budget we got last year, in essence, or will we actually get a budget, or will there be negotiations in this? I don't know. It's unclear as to how every year in the federal budget's been different than the previous one. for the past decade, in essence, maybe since 2010. So, but the proposed cuts are significant between NASA, NSF, and NOAA. That is true. From the House.
Okay, well, on that cheery note.
let me just say one last thing on that. The reality is that if there was a philanthropic corporate private entity that wanted to take and make progress and claim a niche for their own, this I couldn't think of a more interesting, valuable, and a high return from a social investment, not a financial investment perspective. But we haven't found the right funder. We've been looking at this for 3 years as a community. That's how I can say with some authority that we've not found a funder. And I know, some of the conversation Mark and Mindy, you guys have had over the years, it's a really challenging space. But if you wanted to make a difference that you could claim as you had an impact on positively doing this, this is a huge area with lots of talent waiting on the sidelines.
Yeah.
This conversation just reinforces that yet again. But there's nobody's interested, and that it's just we haven't found them yet. But that doesn't mean we're not looking. So maybe that's a better way to leave it.
Opportunities afoot.
And challenges exactly. Rather than problems. Right.
Yeah. Opportunities, yeah.
Good.
Challenges ahead.
Okay, well, that kind of leads, we're getting close to the end of our hour, and I just wanted to make sure everybody is aware next week, so this kind of leads into the conversation. Next week we have a presentation by Rachel Schwarm at Rutgers University on teaching climate social science and its practices, a two-pronged approach to climate literacy. So and that should be really interesting. We will talk again next time.
Tamara, one I forgot. Does everybody know that there's a webinar with John Holdren and our science advisor at NOAA on Monday, June 1st? Do you guys know about that? Did you get that across the network yet?
You want to send a link out to it?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
great.
I signed up for that webinar. Right. I got an email about it.
Yeah, it's with the climate stewards.
Right.
Yeah, but I think we could do a better job of making sure that that the seat license is huge for this one. So, it would be really a shame if our community didn't even know about it. So,
yeah.
I'll
go ahead and send
right
that
now
out. All right, great.
Sure. Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks a
lot. Very good. Bye now.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.